Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, today we begin the study of a new sutta in the series on the Sutta Nipata. This is the third sutta in the group of what I call the three blessing suttas that are commonly recited in the Theravada or Southern Buddhist tradition. And so far we've explained the previous two suttas in this set of three. The Ratana Sutta deals with the qualities of the three jewels of Buddhism, the qualities of the Buddha, the Dharma or teaching, and the Sangha, the community of noble disciples. The Mangala Sutta deals with the progressive step-by-step sequence on the ideal way of life, covering all the different aspects of the ideal Buddhist way of life, starting from the simplest stages through family and social life, all the ways up to the way of life that leads to liberation. And now, with the Metta Sutta, we come to what we might call the ideal attitude for a follower of the Buddha's teaching to maintain towards other living beings. This is the quality called metta. The Pali word is metta. The Sanskrit word is maitri, which means loving kindness. Metta is actually the first in a set of four qualities that characterize the ideal attitude of the Buddha's follower to other living beings. These four qualities are called the four immeasurable states, or the four divine abodes, the four Brahmaviharas. And metta is the first of these, and considered the foundation for the others. Metta is loving kindness, the wish for the welfare and happiness of others. It is the basis for the next, which is karuna, compassion, the wish that those who are afflicted with pain and suffering be freed from their pain and suffering. And then the third quality in this set is mudita, which means altruistic joy, that is rejoicing in the good fortune, the success, and good qualities of others. And then the fourth is equanimity, which we can understand as an attitude of impartiality towards other living beings, or an attitude of detachment towards those, towards beings without having any particular favoritism towards some and biases against others. And so the very foundation of all these four divine abodes is loving kindness. And I think by introducing loving kindness and the other divine abodes into his teaching, the Buddha effected something of a revolution in Indian spirituality. In the Indian spiritual scene before the time of the Buddha, there was a great deal of emphasis upon refraining from harming other beings. This was characteristic of, for example, Jainism. There's a lot of emphasis upon ahimsa, harmlessness, non-injury. And so the Jain ascetics are very, very scrupulous about not doing anything that might injure even insects or ants. But in the Jain teaching, at least the way it was formulated before the time of Buddhism, one doesn't find any special emphasis upon developing positive qualities of love and compassion. And one doesn't find these teachings even in Brahmanism before the time of the Buddha. Later in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, one finds the Brahmaviharas, but where do they come from? Not from the Vedas. They were probably taken into the Yoga Sutras from the teachings of the Buddha. Okay, so the Metta Sutta is considered, you might call, the foundational text for the understanding of Metta. It doesn't give a systematic explanation, but it's a text which is recited and reflected upon and sometimes used as a meditative basis for developing Metta. And as we go through the Sutta, we will see that the Sutta itself is constructed according to the classical pattern of the Buddha's path, which unfolds through the three stages of sila, or morality, ethical development, samadhi, meditative development or concentration, and then at the very end of the Metta Sutta, there is a reference to the qualities of panya, wisdom, and liberation. The fruit of wisdom is liberation. And so the three stages of the path and the fruit are all collected into the Metta Sutta. So loving kindness is not an isolated virtue in Buddhism, but is integrated into the threefold training, and all three stages of the training are brought into connection with loving kindness. According to the commentary, which comes in the Sutta Nipata commentary, there is a background story to the Buddha's delivery of the Metta Sutta. So before we go into the explanation of the sutta, I'll tell the story. Whether you believe the story or not, sometimes there are elements in these commentarial stories. You have to wonder, is this true or not? Or is this just the invention of preachers to entertain the audience? I don't know. But the stories are entertaining, so I tell them. I'll tell it. Okay, according to the story, one time the rainy season was approaching. And during the rainy season, monks would go and find a place to stay, to spend the 3-month period when they can't go wandering and traveling around. And often, when the Buddha was alive, they would come to the Buddha sometime before the rainy season in order to get instructions in a meditation subject. And so, one time before the rainy season, a group of monks, the commentary says 500 monks, but they usually use the number 500 just to indicate a large number. So a group of monks came to the Buddha and asked for instructions in meditation. The Buddha gave them instructions. And then they set out wandering on tour, trying to seek a suitable place to spend the rainy season. They didn't want to stay in the monastery where the Buddha was, since this was in the city of Savatthi, and there was a lot of activity there. They wanted to find a really quiet and secluded place to practice meditation very earnestly. And so as they went traveling through the northern part of India, they came to a region in the foothills of the Himalayas, and they stopped to spend the night. The next day they went on alms round, and when the people in the villages around there saw them, the people were very delighted to have monks. They offered them alms very generously. They inquired into the welfare of the monks. They asked the monks to stay. and the monk stayed there for a few days, and then the people showed that they were really very devout, very earnest about learning the Dhamma. And then they invited the monks and said, why don't you spend the rainy season here? We will build huts for you, simple huts, and we will see, we'll provide you with your basic requisites, your food, any other requisites that you need. We'll be very happy to provide them to you. And so the monks were delighted. There was this very quiet place just in the foothills of the Himalayas, beautiful scene of the mountains in the background, cool breeze, beautiful trees, shady areas where during the day they could sit in the shade and meditate. At night they could go to their huts to meditate. And so it seemed like the ideal place. And so the first few days they sat in meditation through the night. The next day they came out all smiles, very happy, everything went very well. After a couple of days, suddenly all of them, each in their own individual huts, at night they would start seeing strange, frightening forms would appear. Horrible faces would appear just out of nowhere, out of the thin air. They would hear frightening, shrill sounds, screams, shuddering sounds, roaring, growling sounds, not like animals, but supernatural sounds. But none of the monks would discuss with the other monks, but whenever they would meet in the morning to go on their alms round, instead of the smiling face, the faces always looked very grim. They would just go collect their food, they would hardly eat anything, and they would just tramp back to their huts, seeming very discontent, until after a few days, the elder monk in the group gathered all of the monks together and said, what is happening? And the monk said, each monk reported what was happening. And they said, we have to go back and tell the Buddha about this and find out, try to find some other place to stay. Okay, what was happening now? This is the explanation in the commentary. Okay, there are certain beings called earth devas. These are deities that live not in the heavens, but on the earth. And these deities, in this case, they were living in the forest where the monks were staying. And the deities liked the quiet and solitude of the forest. But when the monks came to stay in that forest, for 2 or 3 days, the deities were very happy, because they had some regard for the monks. But when it became clear to them that the monks were going to stay there to continue staying on, it's somewhat like, I'll give you an analogy. Suppose a friend comes to visit you, a friend you haven't seen in a long time, and he drops in, you say, okay, you're welcome, welcome. Please stay a couple of days with me. Okay, and so you give him your own room, you go and sleep in the living room sofa, and you don't mind it, it's quite all right, you're willing to undergo the inconvenience. But then you hear he's making a telephone call, maybe he's ordering something, yes, where can it be delivered? You hear he's giving your address. Maybe you hear him on the telephone. Where can he be reached? What telephone number? He's giving your telephone number. Then you think, what's going on here? And after, okay, 3 days have gone by, 4 days have gone by. He doesn't show any sign that he's going to leave. In fact, delivery man is coming and bringing a trunk load of his things to your house, and it seems like he's settling in. Okay, then you think, I don't want this to go on. So this was the situation that the deities were in. They didn't want the monks to be coming here and settling in their forest. And so they had decided, conspired with each other, that they would try to frighten the monks away. And it seemed that they were going to succeed. And so the monks all left the forest. They went to the Buddha and told him about their problem. Then the Buddha thought to himself, where in this general part of India, where can these monks succeed in their meditation practice? Where can they attain arhatship? He, using his divine eye or spiritual vision, he looked to the region in the south. He couldn't find any place in the south where they could succeed. He looked to the west, no place in the west. To the east, no place in the east where they could succeed. He looked in the north, and his spiritual vision focused only upon one place where they could succeed in their meditation. And what was that one place? What was it? The forest that they had just left. So how could they live together harmoniously with the deities? The Buddha taught them a method by which to win the affection of the deities. And that is, he taught them how to develop loving kindness towards the deities. He taught them the practice of metta bhavana, the meditation on loving kindness. And to help them develop the loving kindness, he also taught them this sutta, the Metta Sutta. And he taught them that they should learn it by heart, get it very firm in their memories, and that they should recite it every day, morning and evening. And so, again, this is the commentary, as the monks return to their forest where they had been living, they approached all together reciting the Metta Sutta, and also while reciting it, radiating loving kindness towards the deities. And while they were radiating their loving kindness and reciting the sutta, the radiations of their loving kindness spread out to the deities and affected them so much that the deities came out to greet the monks. Some deities took their bowls, some took their shoulder bags, welcomed them back to the forest, washed their feet, prepared their lodgings for them, and then the monks lived there very happily in the forest, and they never had any more trouble from the deities. Okay, so that is the background story. And now we come to the sutta. Okay, I have almost the entire sutta in Pali here on the handout. So first I'll recite, then as usual, then read the translation, then give explanation. Verse by verse. Karaniyang atta kusalena yang tang san tang padang abhisamecha sakho uju cha suju cha suvacho cha samudu anatimani. Okay, I read from the translation in the book. He who is skilled in welfare, who wishes to attain that calm state, should act thus. He should be able, upright, perfectly upright. He says of noble speech, I'll have to correct that, gentle and humble. Okay, the way I would analyze this, first, the verse states, who is the practitioner intended by the sutta? Who is the person who is going to practice, to undertake the directions explained in the Metta Sutta? It is one who is skilled in welfare, who is skilled in the good. That is, one who knows what is truly good, what is truly beneficial. And then the purpose for undertaking the practice is to realize that state of peace. Here, the text, it's referring indirectly to Nibbana. It calls it Santang Padang, a state of peace. And it uses the expression abhisamecha, which means, I usually translate this myself, making the breakthrough. And so the ultimate purpose for the practice is to make the breakthrough to that state of peace, to realize Nibbana. But that breakthrough comes through developing the qualities of virtue, concentration, and wisdom. And loving kindness covers the qualities of virtue or morality, and then it becomes transformed from a moral practice into a meditative state. And so we begin with the moral qualities that are the prerequisites for the development of loving kindness. And the first of these is that one should be able or capable. This is sukko. Here, what is indicated is a kind of practical skill in leading the spiritual life, a practical skill in knowing what should be done to cultivate the different stages of the path. Even before one starts, one has to have some idea of the path that one is going to be traveling on. One has to know what are the possible pitfalls that one might encounter, how to deal with those problems. So all of these are practical skills that one needs in advance. Then one should be an upright person. That is, one who is not deceptive, not crooked, not dishonest. And suju, this is an honest person, one who is not hypocritical, who doesn't pretend to have virtues that one doesn't possess. So this indicates a kind of, you call it, sincerity of character, straightforwardness of character. Kind of moral rectitude. Then the next character characteristic, suvacho. It's easy to mistranslate this to mean, to take it to mean of good speech. And so the translator here put of noble speech. I have to say, I don't believe that Venerable Saddhatissa, who is a very learned monk, actually translated this. I think an English editor had worked this over and put his understanding of the Pali in and sort of overruled Venerable Saddhatissa's original translation. Gosuvacho means being easy to speak to, easy to correct. I explained this in connection when I was explaining the Mangala Sutta. It means being, when a person makes mistakes, that it's easy to approach that person and to correct the person. The person is willing to accept advice, open to advice. Okay, the next quality is being mudu. Mudu is being, having a gentle and soft character, not being stiff, rigid, very obstinate and fixed in one's attitudes, but the gentle, soft character, this is the kind of character which readily lends itself to the development of loving kindness. The rigid, stiff character is one who is closed to the feelings of others, but a soft, gentle character is able to open his or her heart to the feelings of others and to empathize easily with others. And so that kind of characteristic, one with a gentle, soft mind, easily can empathize with others and arouse the sense of loving kindness. And then the next quality is anatimani, not being proud, not being arrogant, not being haughty, but being humble. Being willing to regard oneself as not superior to others, but placing oneself on the same level with others. Okay, then we come to the next verse. This is verse number 2. Santu sakocha subarocha apakicho cha salahukavuti santindriyo cha nipakocha apakabo kule su ananukito. Let me just continue on. Na cha kudang sama chare kinchi ye na vinyu pareyu pavadeyo. Okay, that would complete the ethical section. Okay, the seventh virtue that's needed, and here the Buddha is speaking especially with reference to monks, but this also has a wider application, is santusako, which means contented, being easily contented, not having many needs, making many demands, but for monks being contented with the basic requisites of robes, alms food, lodgings, medicinal supports. So the ideal for the monastic person is a simple way of life and being easily contented. And then what goes hand in hand with that is being easy to support. That is just, you call it the other side of contentment. A person who's contented is naturally easy to support. And then virtues 9 and 10 also go hand in hand together. This is for one who's developing loving kindness as a meditation, not to be involved with many duties, because if one takes on many duties, then one's time is absorbed in those, one's time is encroached upon by those duties, and one doesn't have the time to really devote oneself wholeheartedly to the development of this meditation. And so to commit oneself to the practice, the systematic practice of the meditation on loving kindness, one has to lay aside one's duties and become salahukavuti, light in one's activities. By laying aside one's duties are a kind of burden that one takes up. By putting them aside, one's activities lighten up, and so one feels an inner lightness. And then the practitioner is Santindriyo, which means literally with calm or peaceful sense faculties. And what makes the sense faculties calm or peaceful is the practice of restraint of the sense faculties. This is what Venerable Xinxing spoke about so beautifully about 2 weeks ago, the practice of sense restraint. Not letting the senses become entangled with their involvement with sense objects, but drawing the senses inwardly. And then when the senses are drawn inwardly, it's actually the mind that's drawn inwardly, away from involvement with the senses. Then the mind becomes calm, and that calmness of the mind spreads out to the senses, and so it seems that the senses are calm. Then the practitioner is described as nipakko, which means discreet. This is having pragmatic wisdom, being wise in, say, dealing with personal relationships, knowing how to handle relations with people, how to go about one's activities in day-to-day life, having this kind of practical know-how, practical wisdom. And then upagabbo, we could translate as not being impudent or not imposing oneself upon others, not being bold. It seems to be closely related to the sixth virtue of not being arrogant, not being proud, but being not impudent means not being obnoxious in one's speech, not being obnoxious in one's behavior. And then virtue number 14 needs a little explanation. Since this is directed towards monks, it's not being greedy when amongst families. And here now, you see, monastic persons live in dependence upon the support of lay people. And so the Buddha encouraged lay people to support monks and monks to make themselves dependent upon lay people. But the monks are to be contented and easy to support and not to be greedy when they go amongst families, not to be demanding and not to make excessive demands upon lay people, asking for this, asking for that. Okay, now, in the commentaries, virtue or morality is sometimes divided into two general categories. What I call virtue or morality is positive conduct or positive qualities, and then morality as restraint. I wrote these two words, terms down in the outline. One is morality is positive conduct. This is charita sila. And the other is morality as restraint, varita sila. And qualities 1 to 14, on the whole, are 1 to 14 are on the whole can be characterized as morality as positive conduct or positive qualities, even though some of them tend towards morality as restraint. But the trend or dominant characteristic of those prerequisites is morality as positive conduct. But item 15 is morality as restraint. This is varita sila. One should not do anything, even slight, because of which other wise ones might reproach him. That is, when one knows that certain types of actions are against the principles of morality, against the basic principles of ethics, not to kill, not to steal, not to engage in sexual misconduct, not to speak falsely, not to speak slanderous speech, or any of the other basic principles of ethics, then one should not engage in any of those actions. And here, speaking in the monastic context, not to do anything even slightly, that if other wise people see one doing this, they would reproach one. One wants to be impeccable in one's observance of the guidelines to morality. Okay, all of this now, all of these qualities are forming the ethical foundation for the practice of metta. And so as one observes these principles and imprints these principles upon one's character over a long period, the mind becomes gradually and subtly transformed. So it becomes more and more amenable, more and more conducive to the development of loving kindness. But now, with the next part of the sutta, we move into the actual development or cultivation of loving kindness. And so now I will recite that part of the sutta. The transition actually takes place within verse number 3 in the book. So I'll go back and I'll recite from the beginning of verse 3. Nacha. Every time I lose the melody, I have to go to start again. Na cha kudang sama chare kinchi yena vinyu prayupavadeyum Sukhino va kemino hantu. Sabbe sata bhavantu sukhitattha. Ye ke chi pana bhutati. Tasava tavarava anavasesa. Digava ye mahantava. Majima rasakanukatula. Ditava ye va atita. Ye chature vasanti avidure. Bhutava sambhavesi va. Sabbe sata bhavantu sukhitattha. Okay, the section on the meditative development of metta begins with what I take to be a general statement of the principle. What is metta? What is loving kindness? It's almost like it's beginning with a formal definition. What is loving kindness? And we say that loving kindness is the wish for the welfare and happiness of all sentient beings. And that is what is actually being expressed in this statement. So it's saying, Sukhino va kemino hantu sabbe sata bhavantu sukhitattha. Sukhino would literally be happy, but at the end of the line we have sukhitattha, which seems repetitive. So what could sukhino mean that's different from sukhitattha? Here the commentary makes the useful suggestion. Sukhino here should be taken to mean well in body, wishing that beings be physically well, that they enjoy good health. Then kemino is wishing that they be safe and secure, free from harm and danger. And then wishing them sukhitattha, meaning to have happy minds. In other words, simply wishing may all beings be happy. And so in this way, in wishing for the welfare and happiness of beings, one is actually wishing for three things. Wishing for physical well-being or good health, wishing for freedom from harm and danger, and wishing for inner happiness, happiness and peace of mind. And so one begins first with this universal wish for the welfare and happiness of beings. But if one is trying to develop metta as a meditation, you know that it's very difficult just to work with this wish, may all beings be well and happy, may all beings be well and happy. Since if one hasn't practiced developing loving kindness in more specific ways, the mind will, unless one has good roots from previous lives, the mind will quickly get tired just with that general reflection. So from the general reflection, the text moves into developing loving kindness towards specific classes of beings. It takes the whole sphere of living beings and then divides them into different types. According to the commentary, the way it's actually worded in the sutta itself is somewhat compressed for the purpose of verse. But when we actually try to understand it, we have to take these different types of beings mentioned in the text and fill it out by, and expand it by filling in certain gaps in the text. Okay, we begin by taking all beings and dividing them into two classes. The Pali uses two words that come from ancient Indian literature, tasava tavarava anavasesa. The expression tasava tavarava was used in Indian literature to mean everything that is stationary and is moving. And by stationary things, what was meant was vegetation, plant life. And by moving things, what was meant is animal life. But according to Buddhism, plants are living beings, but they aren't sentient beings. They're not beings with individualized consciousness. And so the expression tasava tavarava was taken over, but was given a different interpretation. It came to mean those beings that are frail, weak, and those that are strong. Those things that are moving are the frail beings, and those that are steady, stationary, are the strong beings. And so one develops loving kindness towards all that are weak, all that are strong, dividing all beings into these two classes. Then one takes beings according to their size. Diga va ye mahantava. It's mentioned diga and rasika. So long, middling, and short. Or you could say tall, middle-sized, and short. Then according to their volume, as being large, like gigantic beings, like elephants, whales, middle-sized beings, like human beings, dogs, cats, I guess, are middle-sized beings, small, like even insects would be small beings. Then those beings with gross bodies, those with middling bodies, middle density bodies, those with subtle bodies. I think here by subtle bodies would be beings in other realms of existence, like the Deva realms, the celestial beings, beings with middle density bodies. I'm not quite sure. Middle density? Human beings? Gross density? Animal beings? Okay, the word middling is actually mentioned in the sutta only once, but according to the commentary, it should be filled into these three places in order to get these three groups complete. Okay, then in the next verse, we take all beings divided into those that are seen and unseen. Here we could understand this in, I could understand it in two ways. By seen, we can understand all beings that I've ever seen in my life, and the unseen, all those that I've never seen in my life. But also we could take ditta and aditta to mean those that are visible and adhita to mean those that are invisible. So the visible beings would be the beings in the human realm, the animal realm. The invisible beings, those that are invisible to us, would be the beings in other realms of existence, outside the range of our normal vision. Then the next distinction is between those that are living nearby, those who might be living in our neighborhood, in our town, and those who are living far away. Even those living in, say, North America might be understood as living nearby, those living in other continents as dwelling far. Then the last distinction here, those that have come to be and those about to come to be. Yeah, he makes the distinction, those who are born or those who are to be born. Those beings that have already come into existence, and those beings that are not yet, that have not yet been reborn, but are, you say, in the process of seeking rebirth. Okay, after one goes through all of these classes of beings, and in the meditative development, when one develops some skill and loving kindness, one would take each of these categories as a distinct group and focus the beam of loving kindness upon beings in these categories. One would take a few beings imaginatively from from each category and develop loving kindness towards the beings in representing that category. Thank you. My voice restored to me in a cup of water. So one takes beings from each category and radiates loving kindness towards them until one succeeds in developing the loving kindness towards the beings in each of these categories. Then at the end, after one has gone through all of the categories, then one comes back to the universal radiation of loving kindness with the thought, with the idea, sabbe sattā bhavantu sukhitattā, may all beings be happy. Or again, one could repeat the generalization in the wider form, sukhino vā kamino hantu, sabbe sattā bhavantu sukhitattā, may all beings be well, may they all be safe and secure, may all beings be happy. Okay, at this point I will stop the discourse for today. Then the next time I will take the second half of the Metta Sutta. I'll just take a little sip of water, then I'll ask if there is any questions. Okay, Ken.
Of those who are not being born, who are in the process of seeking rebirth, mm-hmm. Where are they?
I think one would have to say that they're not in any realm of existence, in any of the five realms of existence.
Do they have five skandhas?
Oh, I would think so. This is my personal opinion. It's not a question that I've seen dealt with sort of philosophically in the text. And this is a point where there's differences of opinion between Buddhist schools. Some schools say instantaneous rebirth, as soon as consciousness comes to an as soon as death takes place and consciousness comes to an end in one life, there's instantaneous rebirth into the next life. Other schools speak about an intermediate state between lives. According to the Theravada Abhidhamma, there's instantaneous rebirth. But I have to say, from the evidence of the suttas that I've seen, there seems to be a period between one existence and the next, during which it's not, as I said, it's not explained philosophically, but it seems that in that period, the being is, you could say, waiting for the right karma conditions to appear, if it's to be reborn in the human realm, waiting for the right karma conditions to appear in the human realm so that it can take rebirth back into the human realm. But the question is never dealt with in the suttas. Do they have five khandhas or not?
You introduced that loving kindness is Buddha's very revolutionary practice.
Yeah.
Please explain more. In what way and why it is revolutionary?
I say that it's somewhat revolutionary because I don't think, so far as I can see, Indian spirituality before the time of the Buddha placed so much emphasis upon positively promoting the well-being and happiness of others.
Positive.
Yeah. What I see, if you look in the text of Jainism, one sees a lot of emphasis upon non-violence, harmlessness, non-injury, but not so much on actively promoting the well-being and happiness of others. And I don't know that the words, of course the words metta might have been part of the Indian vocabulary, but I don't know that it figures so prominently in the Jain scriptures. Metta and karuna. But the Buddha placed a lot of emphasis upon those qualities. And certainly in Brahmanism, where they had animal, where animal sacrifice was a very important practice, one would wouldn't think to find much emphasis on loving kindness and compassion there. Though later, through the Buddhist influence, one does find some emphasis on loving kindness and compassion in the yoga stream of Brahmanism. Yeah, David?
Yes, no, I think what I can say, what I know of before the Buddha's teaching, before like Dhammapada, like the Pali Canon and all that, there was, I think the Upanishads had some kind of a positive attitude towards love and towards compassion. That I read somewhere, I might even might have influenced the Buddha up there in some kind of way. But I think that it's kind of like dealt with in the Upanishads a little bit.
I'd have to say the passages in the Upanishads. But we also have to remember some parts of the Upanishads actually come after, were actually composed after the time of the Buddha. Not all of them. The most ancient Upanishads are certainly pre-Buddhistic. But some of them were come from after the time of the Buddha. And so they could have been influenced by Buddhism.
For those who are willing to be reborn,
any of the Yeah, that's what Ken asked me. And I said that the question isn't dealt with philosophically in the suttas. They're just what I would say subtle hints or indications that there is such a state, and whether the sutta should be interpreted to be affirming the existence of such a state, that was a subject of debate between the different Buddha schools. The Theravada school doesn't accept the idea of any state between lives. It believes in instantaneous rebirth. The Sarvastivada, I think, accepts the idea of an intermediate state. And so one finds in the Theravada commentaries, the issue is brought up sometimes and the voice of an objection. The passages in the suttas which seem to be affirming an existence between lives are brought up for discussion, and the Theravada commentator tries to argue against the interpretation of this passage as affirming any kind of state between lives. But the arguments are often not very convincing. Oh. Say again. Yeah, we did have this floating microphone. Oh. But the new recording device might be very good, but my hearing is... Maybe the new recording device could answer your question.
If you want to meditate on a certain person, then what if that person has done something very bad to you? And that generates it.
Okay. The question is, if one is trying to do the loving kindness meditation on persons, and that person has done something very bad to you, then it's very difficult to develop loving kindness towards that person. So how does one develop loving kindness towards that person? I'll ask the machine, did I get the question? Okay, when one is developed in the systematic way of developing loving kindness, one actually doesn't begin going into the classes of beings the way they're laid out in the Metta Sutta, but one takes beings in different groups. We have groups, first oneself, a dear and respected person like a teacher, then a very close person, then a person like a friend, an ordinary friend, then a neutral person, then the hostile person. Okay. We have people in these groups, and when one is developing the loving kindness systematically, one proceeds in that order. First, one develops loving kindness towards oneself. Then one goes towards the dear and respected person, like the teacher. Then a very dear person. Then it could be, one could take a person like a friend, and say an everyday friend, but one who's not so very close and dear. Then a neutral person, the kind of person that you might see every day, well, not, that you see regularly, but you have no personal connection with. Could be like the mailman, person who works in a shop that one goes to regularly, gas station attendant. then the hostile person is last. And when one is developing, until one really succeeds in getting the loving kindness flowing towards the neutral person, one should not bring in the hostile person. And when one brings in the hostile person, one has to proceed very cautiously. I would say, when one brings in the hostile person, if thoughts of ill will, resentment start to arise, one shouldn't immediately retreat. But one should still persist. Still continue with that person. Until one develops some success with that person. But if you find that the thoughts of ill will, resentment are continuing to arise, then you should just back off from the hostile person for the time being and just continue to work with the other people representing the other groups. Work with them till one builds up more strength in the metta practice. Then go back to the hostile person. And then if the resentment continues to arise with the hostile person, there are different techniques to try to overcome resentment towards the hostile person. You could use different lines of reflection. One, you consider that just as I am a human being, and I want to be well and happy, so this person, even though the person seems so nasty and obnoxious to me, but that person is also a human being, just like myself, who wants to be well and happy. Or just as I was brought up by parents who loved me and was deeply concerned with my well-being, this person was also brought up by parents who loved him, who loved her, was concerned with that person's well-being. Or you could try to think of some good qualities in that person and then try to generate a mudita, an appreciative joy, rejoicing in the good qualities of that person. And then from there, turning the mind towards loving kindness towards that person. Or if the person has really bad qualities, strong bad qualities, one could try to feel compassion towards that person because of their bad qualities, and then turn from compassion towards loving kindness towards that person. Okay, just one more question.
I would say of the metta would be unconditional love, where it used to be where I had to have compassion on a person or have mudita or metta. I would have to relate to somebody in misfortune and have compassion on them. Now it just becomes, even if I don't really understand it, I have the compassion as a practice. That's really, really a wonderful thing, I think. I think that every religion should have this practice incorporated into it. But it's very important.
Yeah. Okay, and we will go. We will stop now. Oh, yeah, we have to do the dedication. Okay, we share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, and the other beings. Akasata cha bhumata devanagamahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata cha bhumata devanagamahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata cha bhumata devanagamahidika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mang param. Etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata chamhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.